Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, May 4th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant, last week you probably heard the Supreme Court of the United States struck down, or I shouldn't say struck down, actually, weakened a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. We'll get into the difference between struck down and weakened later in the show. But big picture, the results of this could be manifold, including the severe weakening of the political power of minority voters in this country, especially in the American South. Also, an era of gerrymandering on steroids. We'll explain both potential consequences later this hour. We've got a couple of great guests. Hansi Lo Wong from NPR. You know the voice. You know the name. Also, Nick Corsanidi from The New York Times. We'll hear from both of them this hour. And of course, we would love to hear from you. What do you think the consequences will be from this SCOTUS ruling? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, how you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and I'm sure our listeners have thoughts about this arms race as well. I mean, the state's going back and forth, voting up in air, you know, who gets to vote. It's just
when
it's
is
just
the primary lot. Now?
I know, a lot of going on. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And now we have our trio of news stories.
Tree, yo, you go.
Yeah, Spirit Airlines abruptly shut down over the weekend, sending many in Philadelphia and Atlantic City travelers into a figurative tailspin, wondering what in the world is next. Passengers who showed up to Philadelphia International, they were greeted with a sign that simply said, closed. Spirit Airlines is no longer operating.
That's succinct.
Yeah, pretty succinct. Just closed, period, right? There were no personnel on staff and customer service was shut down. And it left passengers with tickets on Spirit just scrambling to rebook their flight. Many did not have good luck, or they had to pay huge last-minute fares on other airlines. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, passengers who booked through travel agents had to go back to that agent to get a refund. Others who booked directly through the airline were told they would get an automatic refund. And if you use points or vouchers, they told you, hey, get in line because there's going to be bankruptcy proceedings and you'll be in line with the rest of the creditors to get your money back. With regard to the bigger picture here, this shutdown will be felt in our region, especially at Atlantic City International Airport, where Spirit served around 99% of commercial flight passengers.
Say that number again?
99%.
That's a large percent. I believe it only goes up to 100.
Yeah. Look, 1% was non-Spirit. And so a lot of folks worried, what's going to happen to the TSA workers from there? Other folks who service
that
airport?
What's the viability of that airport now?
What's going to happen now that basically the biggest airport, the only airline is gone?
Yeah. Yeah, so farewell to Spirit. We all probably flew Spirit at some point in time.
I've flown them once.
I did not realize it had such a close tie to Atlantic City. And then I went back and read the history of the company. It started as a charter bus operator, and it had a relationship with Atlantic City all the way back then. So AC was like a core part of their business and their business growth over the years. I've never flown in and out of AC, so I just didn't know that. But yeah, I mean, Spirit, well, look, the positive of Spirit is that it definitely introduced competition for the rest of the airlines.
Sure.
Because they were, cutting costs and prices in many ways. And I think that's a big part of the story of why they ended up going under, is that the other airlines kind of came down to meet them and were able to, ultimately outcompete them.
Yeah. And by the way, Spirit and their statement to the public blamed rising gas prices and other financial pressures as the reasons for that abrupt shuttering. But it's hard because, I mean, now the prices of airlines going up this summer, they already said that you could see a 16 to 30% increase because of some of the pressures. So, I mean, no more cheap airlines, I guess. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, at least one less.
One less.
Story number two. Man, this was all over my social media feed. I'm not sure about you.
I definitely saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. So did Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro secretly work behind the scenes to undermine a Democratic candidate for statewide office because that candidate said something negative about him? Well, that is the question raised by a recording released yesterday by the outlet Axios. Axios obtained audio of a congressional candidate and union leader named Bob Brooks telling a group of Lehigh University students that his union backed Republican Stacey Garrity for treasurer in 2024 over Democrat Erin McClellan, specifically because Shapiro told them to. And the reason Shapiro requested this unusual endorsement, according to this released audio from Brooks, is because the Democrat McClellan, quote, came out hard about something on Josh Shapiro. And that could be a reference to McClellan publicly questioning Shapiro as a VP pick for Kamala Harris. Now, Brooks has, since the audio was released, walked all this back, said he misspoke, said Shapiro never told him to endorse a Republican. Shapiro's people also deny it. But obviously, this would be a pretty elaborate thing to misspeak about or misremember, given that asking a union that mostly endorses Democrats to endorse a Republican in a major race is not something that happens all that often. So, of course, naturally, people still have questions.
Yeah, definitely raises some eyebrows, and folks can take the facts as presented and do with them what they will. I think it's a lesson to Brooks, though. Watch what you say, even to students in small groups, because you never know who's recording. And as you mentioned, Brooks is running for Congress right now. But Shapiro endorsed Brooks. You know, according to Axios, they are close. And Shapiro went all out supporting him in his bid for the U.S. House.
Yeah, I don't think he was trying to get back at Shapiro.
And,
I think
they're friendly. And I'm sure, like, the governor is not happy that he has to come out and respond to this.
For sure.
But it definitely is going to, it just, to me, also underscores that if the president were to take a more national approach, you know, in 2028, not the president, the governor, were to run in 2028 for president.
Freudian slip.
Yes. That this is probably he's going to have to deal with this issue, because there have been these rumors swirling about Governor Shapiro and whether or not he would come out against his own party members if they crossed him. And so this bubbles up every so often, and it's something he's going to probably have to address head on.
Yeah, it's a story because it speaks to a core discomfort many people have with Shapiro, which is that he puts his personal ambition or his personal grudges above politics, above ideology, above party, right? Mm-hmm. So they're denying it. They're saying this never happened. We'll probably never know for sure because what other evidence could really surface here? It is a story because it speaks again to a persistent, I wouldn't say pattern, but it speaks to a persistent perception that people have of Shapiro as he has climbed the political ranks.
He's going to have to address it directly at some point. And
if he runs for president.
If he runs.
That's an if he runs for president.
We don't know what's going to happen, people.
We don't have a crystal ball.
No, absolutely not.
And I don't have any secret audio. So we don't know.
Oh, goodness. I'm glad. Okay, third story. So we are dealing with a coffee pastry controversy in our region.
Gasp.
Gasp, clutch pearls. Okay. Apparently, a top-selling pastry sold by numerous coffee shops in the region have been purchased. They have been purchasing. Let me start over. Apparently, a top-selling pastry sold by numerous coffee shops in the region that folks have been purchasing from a Delaware County bakery. Apparently, it is not actually made by that bakery. Oh, no, it is mass-produced by a global distributor.
The horror.
Yeah, and to top it all off, many of these coffee shops, they had no idea. These shops thought that they were buying something that had been baked from scratch locally. Yeah, these golden pastry puffs stuffed with spinach and feta cheese, they are called bistros, and they are made, frozen, and distributed by Sysco. And if you don't know what Sysco is, they make all sorts of
big food
stuff,
yeah.
and they mass produce. But shout out to the Philadelphia Inquirer for this story. Apparently, customers started noticing the bistros all over town. They started talking about it on TikTok and social media. They put two and two together, connecting the pastries to Sysco. And people were pretty shocked, and they felt kind of bamboozled. They're like, look, we're paying the upcharge at the coffee shops when I could just be buying these in bulk myself.
Yeah, I'm putting in my air fryer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look.
What? That's what you would do. You would take the frozen one, just pop it in the air fryer.
Is that a nonsense thing to do?
No, it makes it perfectly crispy.
Yeah, that's what an air fryer is for.
Yeah, it's perfectly crispy.
I don't know how we got on that. That seemed like a very logical thing to say. Anyways, to paraphrase another Sysco, ooh, that pastry is so scandalous. And I don't know if this customer can handle it, Cherry, because I have seen these pastries. Yeah. I have eaten these pastries, and
they
I have
delicious.
Enjoyed them.
They look
They're
delicious.
Pretty darn good. So it gets to a bigger question. If I enjoyed it, did anyone do anything wrong? Because I do feel a little duped and bamboozled buying a frozen pastry that I thought was handmade by somebody. At the same time, I mean, I enjoyed it. It was good.
But I think the thing is, you're paying the upcharge because you think it's homemade. And then what you're getting, you could buy in bulk at a much cheaper price.
It's like if you went to a fancy restaurant and they gave you a McDonald's burger but didn't tell you it was a McDonald's, but you still liked it.
It was still delicious.
Is that wrong? You know what's wrong? You're not responding to my Cisco joke. My thong song joke. That was on you. That was a great joke.
It was so good. I was...
And you laughed at the other thing. That wasn't even a joke. It wasn't even a joke. The other thing wasn't a joke.
I got caught up by the air fryer. I'm so sorry. But we're talking about voting.
Voting. Man, can't buy one today.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. For more than 60 years, the law of the land has been to ensure black voters had representation in Congress through strict rules in the political mapping process. Well, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court threw out that logic and now has opened the door to what analysts say could become a new era of maximum gerrymandering.
The case, which looked at the constitutionality of race-conscious congressional maps in Louisiana, is the latest in which the conservative majority has continued to gut the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Critics are sounding the alarm, saying that it will lead to fewer minority candidates and disenfranchise black voters. Here to help us unpack the case and the broader implications is NPR correspondent covering elections, Hanzi Lo Wang. Hanzi, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you, Cherry. Thank you, Avi.
And of course, we'd love to hear from you this hour. What do you think the consequences will be from this SCOTUS ruling? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Hanzi, wanted to start by getting a real understanding of the scope of this ruling, because voting rights advocates have said that this decision by the Supreme Court has eviscerated the Voting Rights Act. And so I want you to break down, what did the Voting Rights Act do before this decision, and how does this decision specifically change that?
Well, this decision in this Louisiana congressional redistricting case is about a key section of the Voting Rights Act known as Section 2. So this is a key remaining part of the law, because let's keep in mind, the Supreme Court since 2013 has been offering essentially a death by a thousand cuts to the Voting Rights Act. But this last week's decision weakened Section 2, specifically protections against racial discrimination and redistricting. These were protections that were designed to ensure that in places where voting is racially polarized, oftentimes that means places where there is a white majority voters that prefer one candidate, and you have minority voters of color, particularly in the South, black voters who prefer another candidate, it's to make sure that when voting maps are drawn, that minority voters, that they have an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. And so those protections ensured, in a lot of places in the South particularly, that there are a lot of black majority black districts in order to ensure that equal opportunity to elect preferred candidates of minority voters. And what the Supreme Court has done is reinterpreted Section 2, those protections, and has made it much, much harder, if not impossible, to enforce those protections going forward. Yeah.
So what exactly did they say, and what was the court's justification for this ruling? Because we've been hearing a lot about how they didn't actually strike down Section 2, but they so changed its meaning that it's effectively struck down. And it's hard for, I think, a layperson to understand how that could be. So what exactly did they do legally, and then what was the justification for it?
All right. So technically speaking, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act still stands. And what the court has done, the conservative majority has reinterpreted how Section 2 should be applied when voting maps are redrawn. And so basically, since 1982, when Congress amended the Voting Rights Act, what has happened before last week's ruling is that you could challenge a map in places where you think voting is racially polarized, and you think that maps are being drawn in a way that shuts out minority voters, racial minority voters. And there's an analysis that used to be done that looked at the effects of a map. So different types of analysis about the demographics, about voting patterns, just to see if there is some type of discriminatory effect upon minority voters. And what the Supreme Court did last week, which changed how that analysis is done, and essentially emphasized that instead of looking at the effects of a map, what challengers of a map have to do going forward in order to show that there's a Section 2 violation is to look for intentional discrimination. Mm.
So if I say evidence, I'm doing a partisan gerrymander that happens to have a severe racial split, it doesn't matter anymore as long as it wasn't my intent. Like, I never said it out loud. I never wrote it down anywhere.
Right. The emphasis that this Supreme Court opinion by Justice Samuel Alito says that the focus of Section 2 should be intentional discrimination. And so going forward, challengers are going to have to look for evidence that lawmakers are saying we are intentionally trying to discriminate against minority voters, which is a very, very hard thing to do.
Yeah. And Hansi, can you sort of talk about the reaction to that? Because, finding specific evidence of racial or racist intent is extremely hard. So what have you heard from folks in responding to this ruling?
A lot of folks now consider Section 2 as just words on a page, in one way of speaking. You know, you can make that argument because it is so very difficult in order to find statements, public statements by lawmakers in order to show that there was an intent, a conscious intent in court that this map was drawn in order to discriminate against minority voters. A lot of lawmakers know what the rules are, or their lawyers know what the rules are, and so they are not going to be making those public statements. And as Avi said, you know, a lawmaker can say, I'm drawing this map, I'm passing this map in order to partisan gerrymander, to give my political party advantage. And that, the Supreme Court has already ruled, is not reviewable by federal courts, which essentially makes it fair game. Federal courts have no role, the Supreme Court has ruled, in reviewing partisan gerrymandering, which has really let loose this gerrymandering war that we're seeing playing out right now.
About how many congressional districts today are the result of some sort of interpretation of the Voting Rights Act? So in the other way of asking that is, how many districts, as drawn today, are under threat?
Well, those are two different questions. I think it's really hard to tell you exactly how many districts were drawn in order to comply with how the Supreme Court used to interpret Section 2, because a lot of times lawmakers, other map makers knew that was the rule. And so they drew it to be in compliance and were trying to avoid lawsuits. But I've done an analysis and looking at in states, congressional districts in states that are Republican led. And these are districts with sizable minority populations currently represented by a Black member of Congress and were likely protected by Section 2. And there are at least 15 in the South, from Louisiana and going eastward to North Carolina. And these are districts that right now, some of them, you know, we have lawmakers, we have Republican officials in the South over the past few days since the Supreme Court ruling saying these our state's maps should be redrawn. So we're talking about Louisiana, we're talking about Alabama, talking like Tennessee, keeping my eye out for any other states. It is very late right now in this midterm election year to redraw any map in time for the congressional elections. But Louisiana has suspended its primary. And so we're going to watch to see if there's a new round of gerrymandering coming up for Congress.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to remind our listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think the consequences will be from the Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can drop a comment in the chat. MJ says on Facebook, I think the Supreme Court ruling was absolutely despicable. I'm so disgusted with Republicans more than usual. They are craven, deceitful, and wicked. And so, Hansi, I wanted to ask, because right now, a lot of the talk is around Black voters and Black representation in Congress. But African-American voters tend to align with Democrats, right, very strongly. They are very, important part of the Democratic Party's base. Can you talk about it more broadly and what this means for Democrats' representation in Congress? Because if you remove, if you redraw maps and eliminate Democratic led districts, how will that have a ripple effect as well?
Well, this is really ties to what's with the dynamic in the South, which is voting is racially polarized in the way that, you know, white majority voters in a lot of Southern states prefer Republican candidates, and you have black minority voters preferring Democratic candidates. And that dynamic has led to, you know, this situation we are in right now, where Republican-controlled districts, Republican-controlled states have the power right now in order to draw out of existence these House districts that are led by black Democrats. They were drawn in order to comply with Section 2 protections as they were previously interpreted. So without those protections, those districts are essentially, politically speaking, fair game to be drawn out of existence, and it really puts at risk a Democratic stronghold in the South. And again, we are in the middle of this gerrymandering war where Republicans and Democrats are fighting to redraw the maps in order to try to wrestle control over the House of Representatives. And we've had maps redrawn in states all over the country at this point. And so what this ruling by the Supreme Court is opening up this new round of redistricting that really gives an advantage to Republicans, because these majority black districts in the South that are at risk, they are led by Democrats. They're represented by Democrats.
Yeah. I want to read this question in from one of our YouTubers, The Real Aquaman. I'm glad we have The Real Aquaman, by the way, watching on YouTube, not the fake one. The Real Aquaman says, this sounds like it would actually favor either party. If a map is redrawn and favors the minority, no proof of intent could be proven. So I think what this person is bringing up is sort of like the reverse scenario, where in a blue-controlled state, where the Democrats control the state legislature, the governor's office, could they amplify the power of minority voters by redistributing them in such a way that they sort of have a majority in the maximum number of districts? So I guess could you address that question or that possibility, Hanzi?
You know, at this point, you know, I'm kind of watching for anything that can happen. And we're already hearing from blue states, governors, officials saying they want to redistrict. And we can't rule out the possibility that some Democratic-led states, Democratic-controlled states, they may try to draw undue a majority-minority districts that were likely protected under Section 2 in order to gain more of an advantage in elections. You know, it could be some strategy to, in a blue-controlled state, a Democratic-controlled state, to undo these majority-minority districts where there are a lot of Democratic-leaning voters and maybe spread them out into other districts in order to try to make surrounding districts more competitive or to give Democrats a more leading advantage. And so that could be a strategy going forward, because this is really a drag-out fight in redistricting at this point.
Yeah, and we're coming up on the end of the segment, but I wonder, is there a scenario where this sort of backfires on Republican states who think that they can redraw maps and draw out Democratic representation? Any thoughts to that as we wrap up this segment?
Yeah. It's 2026. You got to draw maps using census data. This is census data from 2020. And so people have moved. People's voting preferences may have changed. And so in a lot of ways, map makers are drawing these maps and redrawing these maps using out-of-date data, arguably. And so we're going to see how this plays out this fall and what happens, how this all shakes out. But again, they're using outdated data, so we'll see how accurate it is still in 2026.
Well, thank you so much, Hanzi Lo Wong, NPR correspondent covering elections. Great insight this hour, Hanzi. So nice to see you and to have you on Studio 2.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And let me remind you, our listeners, about our question this hour. What do you think the consequences will be from this latest SCOTUS ruling on the Voting Rights Act? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. After the break, we're talking to a New York Times reporter about what the Supreme Court case could mean for political integrity. Is the future of American democracy going to be partisan redistricting wars forever and ever and ever? Or are there some backstops built into the system? We'll find out in a moment on Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking this hour about the recent Supreme Court ruling that weakened a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. The decision comes at a time when both Republican and Democrat-led states have indicated willingness to redraw voting districts along partisan lines.
Within hours of the decision, the Florida state legislature had already passed new congressional maps to favor the Republican Party. Analysts are saying that we could be entering an era of constant gerrymandering, especially in states with one-party rule.
Yes, and to help us get a better sense of what the future holds, we're now joined by Nick Corisantini, New York Times national political reporter covering voting and elections. Nick, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And our question for you, our listeners, is this. What do you think the consequences will be from the SCOTUS ruling? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can drop a comment in the chat.
And first, let's bring in a caller. This is Al from Philly on the line. Hey, Al, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment for us?
Hi, my comment, first of all, I enjoy your program. My comment is that I think if you care about the destruction of civil rights, particularly in the South, you have to be strategic. And we need organization. We need a means of getting information and ideas to decision makers, which doesn't seem to exist among Democrats, but does among Republicans. One suggestion that I have is that in the South, if you care about this matter, you are a Democrat, you have to register as a Republican in large numbers so that you can at least have some influence in Republican primaries and you have a better chance of eliminating extremist candidates. You have to do much more than that, but that's the first step to actually not losing all of your power.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start there. Al brings up this idea that the changes that are coming and maybe the changes that have already been made, Nick, will lead to less competitive districts and therefore more extreme candidates. Is that a likely outcome here?
Absolutely. It's kind of already happened. We did a big study after the 2024 election about the death of competition. And some of that comes from districting that was done in 2021. In the last round, a lot of states tried to make their incumbents a little bit safer. But it also has just been played out over the past year. And in this hyperpartisan era of trying to make safe seats that, you know, are impervious to swings and more partisanship, then they become less competitive and they're effectively elected through a primary. And as we know, most primaries are decided by the diehards of a party. Base vote turnout is often higher and you start to see sometimes fringier candidates come through there. So it's already been the axe has been taken to competition. Like, we know that in American elections. And this forever redistricting war that it appears like we're entering, at least through this cycle in 2028, is likely to only exacerbate that.
Yeah. I think, Nick, one of the things that has worried me is the outright brashness of the war, and I guess this redistricting arms war that we're seeing. And can you just sort of talk about some of the immediate reaction we've seen to this ruling? And I'm thinking about what happened in Louisiana over the weekend, Tennessee, some of the statements being made there, Florida. Could you just give us an overview of the knee-jerk reaction just in the past few days?
Yeah, and I think we can put those in two buckets. There's the 2026 bucket and the 2028. Now, in the immediacy for the upcoming midterms, Louisiana was kind of put in a tough position by the Supreme Court. They were the state that was at the center of this whole debate. And what led to this decision on the Voting Rights Act was Louisiana's congressional district map being ruled unconstitutional. So they had an unconstitutional map, but they also had primaries starting in 48 hours. They had absentee ballots and military and overseas voters who had already even cast ballots in this primary. So the governor decides to postpone just the House races. And some of the Senate candidates have accused him of playing politics there because he's endorsed in a hotly contested Senate primary. But that is trying to at least redraw a map in Louisiana that would lead to probably one more Republican district, if not two. Now, Tennessee has more time. they aren't in the same calendar crunch as Louisiana. And last week, they also took steps to possibly redraw their maps. There's one Democratic district left in that state. It's in Memphis. I think it has a 60% Black voting age population in it. Obviously, a Black majority city in Memphis. And they're aiming to carve that up to make it a Republican seat, or to add a Republican seat and turn the Tennessee congressional district completely red. Now, there's also a 2028 angle to this. And that's, I think, what shows maybe the bleaker future that you're alluding to, where everyone's going to redistrict. And already Georgia and South Carolina have indicated they need to redraw their maps. Well, need, they want to, and they're citing this as a justification. For Democrats, New York and Colorado have already begun exploring it. Governor Sherrill in New Jersey talked about possibly doing it. Oregon and Washington, a lot of Democrats are also looking at. So you could see this quickly spiraling where everyone's just drawing the most hyperpartisan maps they can, deke out as much partisan advantage as they do. And out with that goes competition. Out with that goes like kind of a more representational house. And that's, you know, the way that the dominoes can quickly fall here.
Deborah from West Philly says, this rush to redistrict feels like a loss of civility and what differentiated this country from others regarding fair elections. It's so depressing. Let me bring in another caller. This is Harry from Philadelphia. Hey, Harry, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
The power to write legislation is given to Congress by the Constitution. And legislation normally deals with behavior, not limited to intention. So the Supreme Court is violating the Constitution by denying Congress the right to pass legislation. The only way the court can set aside legislation if they show it's unconstitutional. They haven't done that. So the court is rewriting legislation. The Constitution doesn't give the courts the right to write legislation. Yeah.
Thanks, Harry. I'm not a lawyer, but the Supreme Court can also rule on interpretations of federal law. It's not just about declaring whether something's constitutional or unconstitutional. It's my understanding. Maybe you can help me there, Nick, and I know you're not a lawyer either. But I guess Harry was worried about what the Supreme Court did and sort of the legality of the court's decision.
Right. I mean, the Supreme Court is the, you know, final arbiter on law. So theoretically, they would be within those bounds. But to understand what they did is it's a little technical. And, you know, the conservative majority claimed in their ruling that they weren't dismantling the Voting Rights Act. They were just changing an interpretation.
Right. They're saying what it means. Right. They're not throwing it out.
Yeah. No. Well, that's how they're trying to pitch it. Right. And what they did was there's been this longstanding test, and I still don't know how to say it after 7 years on the voting rights beat, whether it's jingles or gingles. Right. But it's soft G or hard G. But basically what that was is a legal kind of process that had to be followed to determine if there was a racial gerrymandering under the Voting Rights Act as it existed up until last Wednesday. And what the court did on Wednesday was change that test and basically add, in a layman's version, a new proof that you have to prove intent. And only when you can prove intent is there a racial gerrymander. So if you were doing it just for partisanship or whatever other, you know, justification a state is choosing to draw their new maps, as long as the plaintiff bringing a challenge to the map can't prove intent, then it'll be fine. So they changed that jingles or gingles test to include intent. And then that is what, you know, the liberal justices and a lot of people I've spoken to is like, well, now it's just Section 2 in name only. And they really did, you know, hollow it out.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of follow up with you, Nick, on that question, because it felt like the Supreme Court, which has been for decades, just usually rules on things very narrowly. But this feels like an unusually broad ruling. To me, do you interpret it that way, that this was an unusual move for this court to view something in a much broader sense, to make a much broader ruling that has such wide implications, when in actuality in past they've been very narrow in their decision making?
Well, I think looking at how this court has approached the Voting Rights Act, they actually have made some pretty substantial and expansive interpretations and rulings that have, you know, had broad implications for both politics and elections in the country. And the biggest was back in 2013 in the Shelby case, where they knocked down a different provision of the Voting Rights Act that was known as preclearance, that required states with a history of discrimination at the polls to get approval from the federal government before they changed their voting laws. in an effort to block, you know, racial gerrymandering, voting laws that were discriminatory, and everything that would come from that. And so that was a massive ruling. You know, there was a lot of criticism that they had just gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And they made other decisions, you know, along those lines, too. There's a decision made a few years ago where the Supreme Court removed federal courts from refereeing partisan gerrymandering. And that was another kind of major guardrail, just like lifted off the playing field, saying that you can't bring a partisan gerrymandering case to a federal court. There's state courts, and you know, depending on state constitutions, there could still be challenges. So when it's come to, I think, the Voting Rights Act and a lot of voting policy, the court actually has been pretty expansive in how they've ruled, you know, and it's a lot of, I think, observationists, especially after watching oral arguments in October, were expecting some decision of this magnitude.
Let me bring in another caller. And by the way, our number 888-477-9499, our email studio2@whyy.org. Getting your reactions to this latest Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act. And here's Alice calling from the Poconos. Alice, you're on Studio 2. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Hello, thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to say is that I think the current gerrymandering before the latest Supreme Court decision was terribly unfair and should be illegal. I don't understand why we let the party in power every 10 years further their power by gerrymandering districts that favor them. And some of these districts look like, I don't know, a dragon caught in a spider web.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that districts should be apportioned according to the population of the state, and each district should have approximately the same number of people within the district. And regardless of race or party or ethnicity or anything else.
Thank you, Alice.
And one last thing.
Sure.
I feel that I'm sorry, I lost my thought.
That's okay. That was a good call. Thank you so much, Alice. And I'll add to that an email from Kim, who said, you've talked about the criteria that redistricting has to avoid, but what criteria must redistricting comply with, if any? And so I think, like, one that Alice brought up, like, for instance, Nick, like, still have to have a roughly equivalent number of people in each district. I assume that has not been thrown out. So what is left? What are the rules that govern redistricting at this point? You mentioned that partisanship is not something that has to be taken into consideration. Now it seems like race is out of the equation as well, but what is left?
I mean, at the federal level, you're right. It's really the population, you know, I think it's like 740,000 per district right now for the one person, one vote. And you know, what the 14th and 15th Amendments would require. But absent that, there really aren't a lot of federal protections. Now, there's plenty of states that have, like, very strict laws.
Yep.
You know, Florida is a good example. They have a Fair Districts Amendment that effectively bans partisan gerrymandering, the very thing we were talking about the courts pulling out of. A host of states have independent redistricting commissions, where the goal there was to take the map drawing process out of the hands of partisan legislators or governors or partisan actors and create some semblance of independence.
And on that note, Nick, not to cut you off, I'm sorry, but where are those backstops generally? Are they mostly in democratically controlled states, mostly in Republican controlled states? Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about the future of this, I think one of the big questions is, in what states can a party which holds a trifecta act most aggressively? I would love for you to break down that landscape for us.
Sure. And I think what I was just talking about might be very soon an endangered species.
Right.
For the most part, it's been Republican states have kept the map drawing process in the hands of the partisan legislatures, more so than Democrats. Democratic leaning states installed these independent redistricting commissions, or voters in those states voted them. So you have states like Michigan, California, Washington, Arizona, Colorado, Virginia. Now, two of those states might sound surprising, California and Virginia, their voters had to approve a change to their constitution to remove those to allow the Democrats in the state to gerrymander ahead of 2026 as a response to Republicans in Texas and elsewhere. So I think as we're heading into this kind of era of a forever redistricting war, that those commissions are going to be removed, at least on a temporary status, in a ton of Democratic-leaning states.
Is it easy to remove them? I mean, we saw obviously there were popular votes in places like Virginia and California. They were able to achieve that. But will it be harder in some other states because of different thresholds and standards?
Yeah, it's a state by state process. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what worked in one state might not work in another state, might not even be the legal justification to get there, whether you need a supermajority in your legislature, whether your voter referendum laws require two full legislative sessions before it can go before voters. So there's so many different state laws that it's tough to really game out, you know, who might be first, who has a higher threshold to clear. But there have been leaders, you know, in both parties who are starting to advocate for, like, this is not the time for disarmament. This is the time for armament. And they view taking down those commissions as part of the arms race going on in these redistricting wars.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think the consequences will be from that Supreme Court ruling on the Voting Rights Act? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. Ruth from Chester County says, rich white people have not covered up their intent. Project 2025 and a biased Supreme Court. It is going to have to be we the people who stop them by voting in huge numbers in the primaries and in November. And Frank says, any thoughts on how having a more robust multi-party political reality or allowing open primaries would help offset some of these maneuvers? I started independent, switched to Democrat for a period of time because Philadelphia primaries often determine the election. I went back to Indy, basically giving up my voice locally after the National Democratic Party let me down. And so, Nick, my question is, for a lot of this partisan gerrymandering is very party based. And we've seen the number of people who are withdrawing from the parties grow, especially in our region. You know, a lot of people don't claim either party. More and more people are becoming independent. What does this mean for independent voters if they're no longer in consideration? And you see this very partisan gerrymandering, you're seeing very partisan primaries, and they're sort of boxed out in some states.
Yeah, there's been a shift in this kind of raw, you know, give no inch hyper-polarized era to remove even open primaries, right? Go to closed primaries where only registered party members can vote. And if you couple those rules with extremely gerrymandered maps, you're exactly right. Independent voters, more than any, are just left out of the political process because they can't vote in the primary, and the primary determines the general election when all these seats are very safe and there's no competition. So if you're an independent voter, you've effectively lost your voice when it comes to Congress. So open primaries do at least give them a chance to vote. But at the same time, if these are, you know, hyper-drawn, very partisan gerrymanders, and a primary is still going to be flooded with outside money. There's a two-party system that's going to be able to have more airplay, more name ID, a better ground game. So seeing either a minority party come through there or a third party candidate is still really tough just based on all the structural advantages that come with, you know, being the anointed one from either party in a race.
And then my follow-up to you, Nick, is then sort of, what will it take to stop this? Because if you have the U.S. Supreme Court that just sort of has made these broad swaths new tests that have never been, you know, about race-based and all these different things, what would it take? Would it take legislation? What would it take to sort of put a stop to what is becoming this arms race when it comes to redistricting?
As far as I can tell, sitting here not as like a lawyer per se, it would require an act of Congress. And you know, Democrats did try and do some redistricting reform with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Obviously, that was a massive bill. It tried to do a lot more than just that. But there have been these efforts at the federal level before. And, you know, they're not always going to go somewhere because those in power want to stay in power. And, you know, convincing the opposite party to do something that might remove some of their incumbents from their caucus, or, you know, flip a state that had one time benefited their party, you know, to pass a piece of legislation that erodes that is a very high bar to clear, and certainly not one that we're seeing again in this extremely polarized, like, give no inch, Machiavellian ends justify the means partisan atmosphere that's kind of dominating our politics now.
Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Well, there's one thing that could potentially turn the tide here, Nick, which is that the map drawers mess up. And I want to read this email from Craig, who says, is it possible for redistricting to backfire? Let's say we get to November 2026. Gas prices are $8 a gallon.
God, don't say that.
Grocery prices are up. One-ninth of the people who voted Republican in 2024 vote for Democrats, and none of the Democrat voters switch to Republican. The result, Republicans lose seats, Democrats pick them up. And this brings up the idea, right, that if you go too far with trying to redraw a map and spread out your voters, you could spread them too thin. Are the map drawers just so sophisticated they're not going to make that mistake? Is it possible they could err here and that ultimately what beats this back is just the fact that the politicians say, we can't trust these map drawers anymore. You guys did a bad job.
It's certainly possible. You know, we're in a new era where there's pretty sophisticated map drawing technology where you can carve like by the household. And so they can draw pretty sophisticated maps. But at the same time, just as you mentioned, you can draw maps, but you can't eliminate or erase voters. So there are mathematical limitations if there's so much in a state. And a good example of this fear of this is called a dummy mander. And what that means is when you draw a new map and then you're worse off than you were before you drew it. So it's not like you drew a map to pick up five seats and you only gain three. You still gain three. That's not a dummy mander.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
When you draw a map like Tennessee is doing to try and eliminate one Democrat and then it's a wave election and you end up with three in your chamber, that was a dummy mander. And there are concerns, even from some Republicans in Tennessee, that they might be stretching themselves too thin.
Yeah. I guess my counter to that would be then that if you make that mistake, the way that this redistricting cycle happens now, you can correct that mistake 2 years later because you're not waiting every 10 years. That does seem to be part of the dynamic here. We kind of skipped over. It's not just that you can be more hyper-aggressive in your partisan gerrymander, but also that you can do it more often as you see data change, as you see voter behavior change. How much is that going to factor in, do we think, over the next, I don't know, couple of cycles?
I think significantly, but at the same time, you know, a wave election will be treated as such.
Yeah.
So while it looks very good for Democrats heading into the midterms that, you know, they might pick up seats that they wouldn't in an otherwise more even or even Republican-leaning year. So the Florida map is a good example where that fifth Republican-leaning district, I think it's the 25th, like in South Florida, that could be a tough one for them to hold now, but they still would gladly take that chance
right.
for a map that is going to still probably produce a Republican in 2 years. So they won't always be adjusting and tinkering. I don't think so. But as far as we've seen with this, you know, everything that started when Trump and Republicans in Texas decided to redraw their map in the middle of a decade, which is something that, you know, hadn't happened for 100 plus mm-hmm. years, that changed the norms. And so it's certainly possible they could go tinker, but they also might be just a little reticent from overdoing the tinkering every year and, you know, possibly just making too much work for what's going to end up beneficial in the long run.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Paul on Facebook says this will, as in many other nations, help cause the rise of more just, materially effective, assertive, leftist, socialistic, community-centered, and grassroots-anchored parties and movements. And so I just wonder, you know, we're talking about the political response to this ruling from the Supreme Court last week. We're talking about this gerrymandered redistricting race. I just wonder, will this cause, what could possibly be the ripple effect for voters? Because, you know, the gas prices aside, the view of this administration aside, could there be building distrust with the process generally? And I wonder if some voters will be turned off, confused, and tap out, or if this could cause folks like Hal said or Paul said online to sort of rise up and say, you know what, we don't like politicians tinkering with the system.
It could really go both ways, right? And we've seen it go both ways. When you have a historic gerrymander that you know, has been kind of tamping down one party over decades, it really erodes that party's ability to turn out their voters, to target them, to convince them that it's worth casting a ballot when it just feels meaningless all the time if you're always going to lose. But at the same time, especially in short terms, when there's a move to either restrict someone's access to vote, make it harder for them to vote, or dilute their vote, it can be a real motivating factor. And like, to me, one of the clearest was during the pandemic, Republicans in Wisconsin were trying to force ahead voting for a competitive state Supreme Court seat. And they were trying to push ahead in the middle of the pandemic in places like Milwaukee that were experiencing big spikes and not necessarily expanding options to vote. Yet voters in Milwaukee turned out in record numbers. I remember there were like lines down the block, and it was in response to like, how dare you try and play games with our right to vote? And so that does happen too. And you could certainly see that in the short term. But with a lot of gerrymanders and a lot of moves to sometimes make voting harder, the real corrosive effect is in the long term, a decade later, when it's just been beaten down or ingrained too much in that the almost nihilism sets in with the minority party about what's it even worth.
Well, sadly, he's wearing a hat of your celebrity's favorite basketball team, but we love him anyways. Nick Corsoniti from New York Times. He's the national political reporter covering voting and elections. Nick, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody who called in and emailed and wrote in online on this important topic. And of course, we couldn't do any of what we do without our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.